themselves. Her climbing and crying out continued for 23 hours. Then, as suddenly as she had broken her silence, she fell silent again. Ice gripped my heart, as I thought she might have died. But after about 2 minutes, she spoke again in a loud, clear voice. "Jesus, how are you?" Another minute of silence, and then resolutely, "No, I think I'll stay here." It was 2 a.m. Reagan and I stared at each other, astonished. Had we just witnessed a visitation? I pressed my ear against Deborah's soft cotton gown. Her heart was still beating strong. I kissed her cheek. "It's okay to go with Jesus," I said. "Reagan, Carson, and I will join you in heaven soon." "And Mary Ellen," she whispered faintly. "Yes, and Mary Ellen," I said, thrilled to know she had fully comprehended the moment. Early the next morning, Denver showed up on our doorstep in dirty, ragged clothes, smelling like cigarettes. "Come on in," I said, opening the door wide. "Want some coffee?"
"I didn't come for no visit," he said. "I come to deliver a word from the Lord."
He was agitated and looked like he'd been up all night. He took a seat at the kitchen table, leaned forward, and eyed me.
"Last night, I was driving up on the interstate, Mr. Ron, when I felt the need to pull over and pray. So I pulled over on the side of the road up on that hill that looked over the city, and that's when God spoke to my heart. God says, 'Miss Debbie's spirit is crying out to be with the Lord,' and showed me visions of angels coming into her room to take her home. But the saints on earth was holding on to her body 'cause her work here ain't finished yet."
He told me he had seen Jesus and angels and lightning. He also told me what time he'd seen this vision. Precisely the same time it had happened in her home. It had now been more than 3 weeks since Deborah had eaten. Her skin clung thinly to her limbs like gauze, hugged her cheekbones, crept into her eye sockets. How many times had various doctors predicted she would not live through the day? And yet a foolish old homeless man had been far more accurate than the learned medicine men. The next morning, Denver knocked at the kitchen door again. We sat at the kitchen table, stirred our coffee. He dropped his head and paused a long moment, unhurriedly collecting his thoughts like shells on a beach. Then,
"God gives each person on the earth a set of keys. Keys to live this life down here on earth. Now, in this set, there is one key you can use to unlock prison doors and set captives free."
Denver turned his head just slightly, so that the right side of his face was closer to me than the left. He leaned in with his right shoulder and narrowed his eyes even farther.
"Mr. Ron, I was captive in the devil's prison. That was easy for Miss Debbie to see, but I got to tell you, many folks had seen me behind the bars in that prison for more than 30 years, and they just walked on by, kept the keys in their pocket, and left me locked up. Now, I ain't trying to run them other folks down, 'cause I was not a nice fellow, dangerous, and probably just as happy to stay in prison. But Miss Debbie was different. She seen me behind them bars and reached way down in her pocket and pulled out the keys God gave her and used one to unlock the prison door and set me free."
Denver pounded home those last words like 8 separate nails, then sat back in his chair, sipped his coffee. He put the mug down.
"She's the onliest person that ever loved me enough not to give up on me, and I praise God that today I can sit here in your home, a changed man, a free man.
Chapter 48, November 1st. A week past our anniversary, the hospice doctor and nurses were beyond amazement that Deborah was still alive. They had stopped making predictions and instead discussed how the books on dying should be altered, or at least footnoted to include the possible outcomes of people like Deborah, who, when death came calling, summoned the strength to reschedule and politely close the door. For months, we had been in a long Texas drought, but now dark skies brought cold, sluicing rains. I imagined that the angels were crying, but why? I thought bitterly. It seemed God was getting his way. I remembered what Denver had said, that he needed to take home some good folks to work his will on earth. I thought that was a crappy plan. That morning, Deborah lay in our bed, still and spectral. But at noon, her body began to tremble, then convulse. Within seconds, violent seizures began ripping through her torso and limbs, her face contorted in pain. I jumped into the bed and tried to hold on as she shook and thrashed, pleading silently with God to stop torturing her. Alan, Mary, the kids, and the hospice people watched in growing horror. After 2 hours, I leaped out of the bed and literally shook my fist at heaven. Stop it, God, please! For 2 more hours, Deborah writhed on the bed like a live power line. After what seemed like a frantic consultation, the hospice people decided to give her phenobarbital. The dose was enormous. It would probably stop the pain, but it might kill her. The hospice doctor asked if I was willing to administer the drugs. I consented without hesitation. I would have done anything to stop her suffering. Still, I wondered if I was signing her death warrant. As the drugs began to flow, her tremors subsided, closing off what might have been a glimpse into hell. Without a doubt, I was now ready to see her safely to her eternal home, and I thought she must be ready to go, too. November 2nd. Early in the morning, the doorbell rang. When I opened the door, I saw Denver standing there, ragged, looking again like a vagrant who had not slept. But his eyes were different this time, blank and hollow, almost as if he were in shock. I hugged him, but he only stood there, as though he was too exhausted to respond. He kept his head low and for a couple of minutes wouldn't look me in the eye.
"I didn't come for no coffee and no visit," he said as we took seats at the kitchen table again. "I come to deliver a word from the Lord."
By this time, my towering faith had crumbled. The experts had failed, I had failed, and God, it appeared, was on the verge of failing, too. The God who promised that whatever we asked for in faith would be done in heaven had not delivered. But I also knew it was Denver who had first predicted that a thief would come for Deborah. And when the doctor said Deborah wouldn't last another day, Denver said she would, and he was right. Denver knew about the angels before anyone had told him what had happened in our bedroom. Somehow, in a way I couldn't understand, this simple man was dialed into God. So when this time he said he had a word from the Lord, I decided I needed a witness. I bounded up the stairs and summoned Carson. As soon as we returned to the kitchen together, Denver fixed us with his eye, narrow and intense.
"Mr. Ron, I've been out on a hill overlooking the city all night long, and I heard from the Lord. He said Miss Debbie's body is crying out for paradise, but the saints here on earth still has a chain around her and won't let her go. So the Lord told me to come and break the chain. I didn't speak, but flashed back to Deborah's violent seizures, her crying out. Was she crying out for paradise? And I wondered what the chain could be, and who were the saints? Later, I learned that 30 of Deborah's friends had gathered in our yard the evening before and, linking hands, encircled our home to pray that God would heal her. Denver continued, "The Lord also told me to tell Miss Debbie that she could lay down her torch, and the Lord told me to pick it up. So, Mr. Ron, out of obedience to God, I'm here to break the chain, and I'm going to ask you and Carson to pray with me to break it." After 19 months of praying for a miracle, it seems strange now to be praying for God to take Deborah. But as I began, new promises from Scripture came to my lips, unbidden. "Father," I prayed, "help us as a family to fully give Deborah over to you. Help us trust that you have ordained from the beginning the number of our days and that you won't take Deborah until she has completed the number you have ordained for her." When we finished, Denver drilled me with a stare and surprised us with words that seemed to contradict his prayer. "Still, Miss Debbie ain't going nowhere till her work on earth is through." Then tears spilled from his eyes. I had never seen him weep. His tears flowed into the lines in his face like rivers of grief, and it hit me again how much he loved Deborah. I marveled at the intricate tapestry of God's providence. Deborah, led by God to deliver mercy and compassion, had rescued this wreck of a man who, when she fell ill, in turn became her chief intercessor. For 19 months he prayed through the night until dawn and delivered the word of God to our door like a kind of heavenly paperboy. I was embarrassed that I once thought myself superior to him, stooping to sprinkle my wealth and wisdom into his lowly life.
Chapter 49. I'd shed plenty of tears when I was praying out by the dumpster, but I hadn't ever cried in front of Mr. Ron before. I couldn't help it, though. I knowed everything that could be done for Miss Debbie had been done. The doctors had done all they could do. Mr. Ron had done all he could do. And God had laid it on my heart that it was time for Miss Debbie to go on home to be with him. But grief had still grabbed a hold of me, and them tears spilled out before I knew what hit me. I tried to catch him with the backs of my fingers, and I could see Mr. Ron and Carson sitting there staring at me, a little bit surprised. Then they both looked down and started stirring their coffee. That's when I got up and headed down the hall toward Miss Debbie's room. I didn't plan to do that. Seemed like the Lord just tugged at me, and I felt like that's what I was supposed to do. The bedroom door was standing open, and there Miss Debbie was, laying on her back in the middle of the big bed, thin and weak-looking under the sheet. The curtains was open, and the morning light was gray, coming in through the rain that drizzled down the glass. Her eyes were closed, and her face had mainly wasted away till she didn't look much like herself, except for still being beautiful. I stood there for a spell, just watching her breathe. "How you doing, Miss Debbie?" I said after a little while. But she stayed still, her chest rising and falling in the quiet. Now, I'd been in to see her several times, and Mr. Ron or Miss Mary Ellen or somebody always be there, just 'cause there wasn't hardly ever a second when somebody wasn't right by her side. Since we just prayed that prayer of letting Miss Debbie's soul sail on off the glory, I was kind of surprised Carson and Mr. Ron didn't follow me back to the room. I figured they wanted to be there in case we needed to pray the same thing right here with her. But they didn't come. Me and Miss Debbie was alone. Looking back, I think maybe the Lord opened that little window in time to do his business. I was standing on the left side of the bed, with her head by my right hand and her feet by my left hand. The sheet covering her thin body rose and fell, just a bare little bit. With her face turned up toward heaven the way it was, she couldn't see me, and I wasn't even sure she could hear me. And I wanted to be sure she heard what I had come to say. So I put my right knee on the bed, then I slipped my hand up under her head and raised it off the pillow just a little bit and turned her head to my face. "Miss Debbie," I said. She opened her eyes wide, staring straight at me. I know she could hear me then, so I went right on. "I can understand how important it is to you that we keep on reaching out to the homeless. Now you done did all you could do, and God has put it on my heart to tell you that if you lay down the torch, I'll pick it up and keep your ministry to the homeless going." She didn't move or say nothing, but her eyes started to shine up with tears. My heart started pounding, aching in my chest like it was too big for my body. "So you can go on home now, Miss Debbie," I said. "Go on home in peace." Her tears spilled over then, and my heart stretched until I thought it would tear in two. I kept holding her head up so she could see me. Then I said the last words I ever spoke to her. "Farewell. I'll see you on the other side." I laid her head back down on the pillow, and she let her eyes slip closed. And I know that she knowed we'd never see each other again. Not in this life.
Chapter 50, November 3rd. I no longer slept. I lay with Deborah through the night. She lay beside me, gaunt, her eyes fixed open, mouth slack, lifted heavenward as if on the verge of a question. Her chest rose and fell sporadically, sometimes in short, quick hitches, sometimes not at all. I watched red minutes tick by on the digital clock, eating up what remained of the life we had built. As dawn crept into the room, thunder rumbled. I could hear rain showering down the eaves, streaming through the gutters. My New York partner, Michael, had called and asked if he could come see Deborah, and was on his way down. I had tried to discourage him and others from coming during these last weeks. Deborah had wasted away so that she barely raised the sheet that covered her. Her eyes had faded and seemed cruelly suspended in sockets of protruding bone. I wanted everyone to remember her as the beautiful, elegant woman they'd always known. But Michael pressed, and since we were godparents to his son Jack, I said yes. Jewish by birth, he was not a particularly religious man. He knew we were Christians and had witnessed our own trek of faith. We talked about Jesus as Messiah, but that didn't mesh with his own religious upbringing. Ours were philosophical discussions, friendly, never heated. When Michael pulled up to the house at around 10 a.m., Mary Ellen and I were in the bedroom with Deborah, singing along to a CD of Christian songs, some of Deborah's favorites. I went out to greet Michael. Then he, Carson, and I went back to the bedroom. The moment Michael stepped through the door, the song, "We Are Standing on Holy Ground," began to play. "We are standing on holy ground, and I know there are angels all around. As the song washed through the room, Michael looked at Deborah, then at Mary Ellen. "We are on holy ground," he whispered. Then, as though someone had kicked the backs of his legs, he fell to his knees and wept. Frozen in place, Carson, Mary Ellen, and I traded glances. In the 20 years I had known him, I had never seen Michael cry. When the song ended, he collected himself, pulling out a picture of Jack. He moved to the edge of the bed and placed it in Deborah's palm, gently folding her fingers around it. "Will you watch over him from heaven?" he said. "Be his guardian angel?" The moment later became a mystery. No one ever saw that picture of Jack again. Michael thanked Deborah for all the prayers he knew she had prayed for him. She didn't move or speak. He stayed about 20 minutes. When I walked him down through the living room, he seemed dazed. There was a power or a presence in that room that was not of this world, he said. "All the times you spoke to me about an encounter with God, I just had one. I don't think I'll ever be the same." That was all we said. He ran through sheets of slanting rain and ducked into his car. Michael had always held faith at arm's distance. Denver's words echoed in my mind. "Miss Debbie ain't going nowhere till her work on earth is done." "Is it done now?" I wondered. I bounded down the hall and told Deborah about Michael. Though she remained silent, I knew that she knew. Her pulse had dropped to a whisper, her breathing to an irregular series of shallow gasps. I lay down, wrapped my arms around her, and waited for the angels. Chapter 51. "Come quick. She stopped breathing." It was Daphne. She'd come running upstairs in a panic. I had left Deborah's room less than 15 minutes earlier, ushered away by Carson and Reagan, who insisted that I get a couple of hours of sleep. At about 10 p.m., I had traced Deborah's face with my fingertips and kissed her forehead, afraid to leave for fear I'd never see her alive again, and gone upstairs. Daphne took my place, prepared to keep watch all night, but at 10:15 she burst into the guest room where I had lain down. For 19 months I had hardly let Deborah out of my sight. For the previous 3 weeks I had seldom left her side. I had been there for 31 years and 7 days of living. But it was Daphne, who had entered the world with her 55 years before, who saw her sister safely home. The hospice nurse was standing over Deborah when I entered the room. I crawled up on the bed beside my wife. Her eyes were still open. I closed them. Quietly, I asked the nurse to remove the tubes and IVs that had bound her for a month. Then I asked the nurse to give us a few minutes alone, during which I held my dead wife and wept, begging God to raise her as Christ had raised Lazarus. When he didn't, and I truly believed he could, my heart exploded. Within minutes, a nondescript-looking man who introduced himself as the medical examiner appeared in our bedroom to pronounce her dead, as if I didn't know. Then two men who had arrived in an unmarked white cargo van appeared to take her body away. Dressed in navy blue shirts and trousers, they looked for all the world like washing machine repairmen. I'd hoped they would look like angels, but they didn't. And I'd hoped they wouldn't look like morticians, but they did. That night, Daphne brought two tiny white pills that Alan said would help me sleep. As I lay in bed, my mind drifted to Rocky Top, and questions needled my heart. Silly things like, who would give our baby longhorns their names, and who would pick the peaches in July, and make the cobbler that scented the house with cinnamon? The last thoughts to cross my mind caused me to cry myself to sleep. That Deborah would not see Carson and Reagan get married. That she would not meet our grandchildren or watch them ride calves at Rocky Top. After I roped them on Christmas morning like my granddaddy had done for me, I guessed I could still do it. Maybe God would let her see. Chapter 52. 3 days later, we buried Deborah in a simple pine casket on a lonely hill at Rocky Top, just the way she wanted it. The weather, though, at first seemed a slap in the face. The kids and I had driven out to the ranch that morning in a flashing thunderstorm as winds from the cusp of winter blew cold sheets of rain across the highway. Bitterness seethed in my heart. Maybe I was under some kind of divine punishment, but Deborah certainly didn't deserve this. The burial site was the highest point on Rocky Top, a small clearing guarded by wizened oaks. It had always been one of Deborah's favorite nooks on the ranch. She especially loved the spot where an enormous flat boulder rested like a bench in the shade of a leaning oak, forming a natural gazebo perfect for prayer or simple solitude. When Carson, Reagan, and I drove up the hill, Roy Jean, Pame, and other friends were spreading hay to soak up the huge puddles formed in the drenching rain. They had also uncovered the grave, a sight that unnerved me. I don't know what I had been expecting. I knew we weren't burying Deborah in a traditional cemetery where headstones and epitaphs somehow affirm the civility of the final rite, but with cruel clarity it hit me that her final resting place was nothing but a dark hole in desolate ground where wild animals foraged at night. A wave of nausea rolled through my guts, and I nearly collapsed under the reality of what we were about to do. Mercifully, the weather broke. Like a minor miracle, the skies cleared and the cold north bluster reversed itself, replaced with a warm southern breeze that breathed over the hilltop, drying out the ground in less than an hour. Denver arrived, along with about 100 friends and family. Like country folks, we sat around Deborah's grave on hay bales. Someone had saddled Rocky, her palomino, and left him tied nearby. For the next hour and a half, we honored my wife. We sang old-time spirituals and country hymns, accompanied by two cowboy friends playing acoustic guitars. Warm sunlight filtered through the oaks, casting circles of gold on Deborah's pine casket, so that the simple box she'd asked for appeared covered in shimmering medallions. In no special order, folks stood up and shared Deborah's stories. Unsurprisingly, Denver remained silent. I ended with a poem I had written for her on our anniversary. Pame walked through the crowd with a bucket of bluebonnet seeds, and I watched as each mourner scooped out a handful and scattered it on the moist ground. Then the kids and I got into the Suburban and drove away, leading a procession of cars down the dirt road to the ranch house. Denver and the other pallbearers stayed at the site to lower Deborah into the earth with ropes. As I left my wife on the hilltop, I tried not to think about the shovels I had seen leaning behind a tree.
Chapter 53. When we let Miss Debbie down into the ground, I knowed it wasn't nothing but her earthly body. But I still felt my heart sinking right down into that hole. I knowed God had a plan and a reason why he took her. But I still didn't understand why he gonna cut off such a beautiful life while the whole world was crawling with criminals and fellas like me that ain't never done nobody much good. After we got her casket down into the grave, me and Mr. Roy Jean and some other fellas picked up them shovels and started in. I hated the sound when that dirt thumped on the wooden coffin and showered down around it like an evil rain. Even though I know Miss Debbie's spirit was with the Lord, I tried real hard not to think about what was inside that box. I was glad when all I could hear was the dirt hitting dirt and not hitting that casket no more. After we was finished, there was a fresh pile of red earth where the hole used to be. One of Miss Debbie and Mr. Ron's friends had made a big cross out of cedar wood with the bark still on it, lashed it together with rawhide. Somebody used a shovel and pounded it in the earth up by her head, and that was it. The place didn't look no different than no other place on the ranch, except for that big red scar on the ground. After everybody went on to the house, I stayed up there with her, sitting on a bale of hay. Sometimes I talked to God, asking him why. Even though I had a word or two from him about his purposes, and even though I delivered them words to Mr. Ron like he asked me to, that didn't mean I had to like it. And I told him I didn't like it. That's the good thing about God, since he can see right through your heart anyway. You can go on and tell him what you really think. Since I know what nobody gonna hear me, I talked to Miss Debbie too, out loud. You was the only person that looked past my skin and past my meanness and saw that there was somebody on the inside worth saving. I don't know how, but you know that most of the time when I acted like a bad fella, it was just so folks wouldn't get too close. I didn't want nobody close to me. It wasn't worth the trouble. Besides that, I had done lost enough people in my life, and I didn't want to lose nobody else. Well, it was too late for that, but I didn't regret letting Miss Debbie get close. Instead, I thank God for her life and the simple fact she loved me enough to stand up to me. That got me to crying. I cried and cried out loud and told Miss Debbie that was the most important thing she taught me. Every man should have the courage to stand up and face the enemy, I said, 'cause every person that looks like an enemy on the outside ain't necessarily one on the inside. We all has more in common than we think. You stood up with courage and faced me when I was dangerous, and it changed my life. You loved me for who I was on the inside, the person God meant for me to be, the one that had just gotten lost for a while on some ugly roads in life. I don't know how long I sat up there on that hay bale, but it was morning when we buried Miss Debbie, and night when I finally got through talking to her and went on home.
Chapter 54. The next morning we held a memorial service at church, under strict orders from Deborah that it was to be a celebration. Denver planned to follow us there in his car and arrived in our driveway looking stylish, in a dark pinstriped suit and tie. I got out of my car and gave him a long hug. I'd heard from a friend who had attended the burial service, that when she left Rocky Top at twilight, she had seen Denver still sitting by Deborah's grave. The church parking lot was already packed when we pulled in, and I had to find a parking spot like everyone else. Deborah had not wanted limos or anything else that would make it look like a funeral. Inside, nearly 1,000 people had gathered, and for the next 2 hours, Deborah's close friends and family shared memories of a life well lived. Sister Betty was among those who stood to speak. Slender and soft-spoken, she walked to the podium and told briefly of how God had led Deborah to the mission and how they had become sisters in Christ with a common goal to change the city. Then she looked down at Denver, who was seated in the front row just in front of Reagan, Carson, Daphne, and me. Now, Brother Denver has a few words to say. Denver pulled out his handkerchief and mopped his head. Then he rose from his seat and walked slowly to the dais. I glanced at Carson and Reagan, and we shared a smile as Denver's ponderous gait made the climb up the podium seem like a mountain trek. Normally soft-spoken, Denver this day needed no microphone, and a rousing voice that grew louder and stronger with each word, he delivered a message about courage, hope, and the love of a woman. God has blessed me that someone would come to me that was concerned about me and not interested in whatever bad places I had come from. Ever since I'd known her, Miss Debbie offered for me to come to church here. But wasn't no way I was coming here, Denver said, smiling as the mostly white congregation laughed. So she came and got me and brought me. I tried to stall at the door, but she said, come on in. And she walked in here, and with me just as proud, she was a real lady. As Denver told the tale of the white ladies in the retreat, laughter rang, and when he told how God had prompted him to pick up Miss Debbie's torch, people cried. Reagan and Carson, their own tears flowing, squeezed my hands, thrilled to witness this answered prayer, and so proud of their mom, whose legacy was sealed by the powerful testimony of a man who'd survived some of the worst America has to offer and trouble of his own making, a man whom we now considered a member of our family. As Denver left the podium, I saw Roy Jean and our friend Rob Farrell stand and begin clapping. Then the entire congregation stood and applause thundered through the church. For 19 months we had prayed for and expected a miracle. Suddenly, I realized I was staring one right in the face. A face that didn't try to hide from me anymore. A face with eyes that were no longer angry and yellow, but clear and a powerful brown. A face that beamed a joyful smile when it seemed once to have forgotten how. As Denver lumbered down from the dais, the applause continued. Reagan, Carson, and I stood, tears streaming, and when he reached us, gathered him into our arms. Chapter 55. Never one to leave details to chance, Deborah had told us that after she died, she wanted Carson, Reagan, and me to take a trip somewhere, just the three of us. We were to leave right after her memorial service, she said, stay at least 1 week, and not talk about anything sad. She had issued these orders a month ago, on her last day in the hospital. That day, the four of us sat in her room and yakked about where we should go. Italy, I suggested. We can stay with Julio and Pilar in Florence. We'll eat pasta, drink wine, and laugh over memories. Too far,
Reagan said, ever practical. I want to float the Rio Grande and hike in Big Bend. Deborah liked that, and Carson agreed, so it was decided. Desolate Big Bend National Park in far west Texas. Per Deborah's instructions, we packed the car the day after the service and were literally walking out the door when the phone rang. It was Don Schisler. Ron, can you come down to the mission right away? Not really. The kids and I were just leaving for a week in Big Bend. But this can't wait. Can you stay by the phone for a minute? I'm going to have Bob Crow call you right back. Bob was a mission board member. I said I'd wait. Within a minute, Bob was on the phone explaining what he described as the most powerful move of God in the 112 years of the Union Gospel Mission. Here's what happened. Immediately after Deborah's memorial service, a couple named John and Nancy Snyder approached Bob, saying they wanted to make a major gift and assist in raising additional funds to build a new Union Gospel Mission. The existing mission was aging and beyond repair, and it was Sister Betty's powerful testimony and Denver's story of how Deborah's love for him had changed his life that had stirred their hearts. That news alone stunned me, but what Bob said next made my knees wobble. Ron, they want to build a new chapel for the mission and name it the Deborah Hall Memorial Chapel. My throat closed, and tears surged. I could barely squeeze out the words. We'll talk it over during our trip, before hanging up. Carson and Reagan were elated about the gifts for the new mission, and we left for Big Bend with high spirits, mercifully buoying our heavy hearts. We debated the chapel naming issue as we barreled down the road in the Suburban, loaded down with boots and backpacks. All of us were positive Deborah wouldn't want her name emblazoned on anything any more than she'd wanted the red Rolls Royce boasting from our driveway. If mission donors wanted to name the new chapel after someone, it should be Sister Betty. We all agreed at first. Then from the back seat, Carson threw in a monkey wrench. Isn't it usually the people writing the checks who get to name the place their money is going to build? We chewed on that for a minute, Reagan staring out the window at the chaparral whipping by. You know, Dad, she said finally, they didn't ask us to name the chapel, just to give our blessing to the name they already picked out. We tabled the subject for the duration of the trip. At Big Bend, the Rio Grande meanders through the shimmering arroyos of the Chihuahuan Desert, the jagged peaks of the Chisos Mountains towering above. We hiked the rim rocks and floated down the Chili River through narrow canyon cuts, sheer volcanic walls soaring over our heads into a vault of blue. It was a simple escape, clean and austere, a monastery of sky and stone. The week passed slowly, blessedly free of the noise of living. I thought about Deborah, jumbled images flashing randomly through my mind as though someone had reshuffled our lives into some kind of anachronistic slideshow. Deborah holding baby Carson, Deborah frail and dying, Deborah saying, I do, Deborah laughing on a ski slope, serving meatloaf at the mission, baking with Reagan. I thought about Denver. Again, random pictures. Denver's words at the memorial service, my putting my hand on his knee at the caravan. Denver with Mr. Ballantyne. Denver praying by the dumpster for Deborah. There would be, I knew, no catch and release. When our time at Big Bend was up, we were ready to come home, and the moment we emerged from the desert into cell phone range, I found I had a message from Don Schisler.
Chapter 56. While they was gone to the river, I prayed for Mr. Ron and Carson and Reagan that God would bring them a time of healing. There's something special about a river, something spiritual that I believe goes all the way back to the River Jordan. Wasn't no kind of trip gonna make Mr. Ron and his kids feel better about losing Miss Debbie. But I prayed they would have a time of refreshing out there where there ain't nothing but what God has made. I knowed when they come back, I was gonna have to get dressed up again. Mr. Schisler had done invited me to come to something he called National Philanthropy Day. He'd already invited Mr. Ron. Said he left him a message on his cell phone to remind him. Miss Debbie was one of the folks they was gonna honor. I wasn't too happy to be putting on a suit for the third time in a month, but I was all for participating in anything that would let folks know what kind of woman the Lord had called home. The morning after he got back from the river, Mr. Ron come by the mission to pick me up. I had on a suit I had got at the mission store that seemed like it was brand new. When Mr. Ron saw it, he smiled and said I looked like $1 million, so I figured I'd done pretty good. They was holding this National Philanthropy Day ceremony at the Worthington, a rich folks' hotel on Main Street. When we walked into the lobby, there was about 1 million people crowding around, waiting to go in through some big old fancy doors that Mr. Ron said went into the ballroom where they were having this shindig. We hadn't been there but a few minutes when people I'd never seen in my life started coming up to me. This one lady wearing a pearl necklace and a hat says to me, "I heard you speak at Deborah's memorial service. What a wonderful story. Denver, I want to shake your hand," said a tall, skinny fella with a diamond sticking out of his necktie. "I'm so glad to hear how you turned your life around." On and on it went like that, with strangers coming up to me and calling me by my given name. I started to sweat. Mr. Ron just smiled and said maybe he should be my agent. When them ballroom doors finally did swing open, I thanked the Lord and hoped nobody be congratulating me no more. Now, Mr. Ron had taken me to some fancy places, but that ballroom was probably the biggest, fanciest one yet. Looked like somebody hauled in all the silver and crystal in Texas and laid it all out on round tables draped with dark red tablecloths. I sat down beside Mr. Ron and tried to act like I belonged there, but I couldn't help staring up at the chandeliers. Mr. Ron saw me grinning. "What are you thinking about?" he said. "I've been seeing this hotel from the outside for 20 years, I said, "but I never figured I'd ever be on the inside." When I was still on the streets, I told him, I used to come down to the Worthington on the coldest nights and slip in behind the hotel where they had some of them big fans that blow hot air onto the sidewalk. I'd sleep on top of the grates to keep warm. One of the security guards took a liking to me. Just to be nice, he used to come by every now and then and kick me a little to make sure I hadn't froze to death. Sometimes he'd even bring me some hot coffee. He never did run me off, I told Mr. Ron. Long as I didn't make my bed till after midnight and was gone by 6 in the morning, he'd let me stay. "Did you never even walk in the lobby here? I think all hotel lobbies open to the public." I looked Mr. Ron in the eye. "Homeless folks ain't no public," I said. I guess I was public now, though, 'cause I saw my name on the invited guest list. When the food come, I took my cloth napkin and put it on my lap, and I kept my eye on Mr. Ron to make sure I was using the right fork. I had learned by then that rich white folks got a lot of rules about forks. I still ain't figured out why they got to use 3 or 4 different ones and make a lot of extra work for the folks in the kitchen. We'd about finished eating when Mr. Ron brought up the subject of naming the new mission chapel after Miss Debbie. We decided against it, he said. We don't think she would have wanted to draw attention to herself that way. I got real serious with him then. Mr. Ron, Miss Debbie is in heaven, and this is not about Miss Debbie anyway. It's about God. Are you going to get in the way of God when he's on the move? Mr. Ron shook his head kind of hangdog. No, I guess not. Then just get out the way and let God do his thing.
Chapter 57. Denver Moore made his way through the glittering crowd of the wealthiest people in Fort Worth and, with grace and dignity, accepted a philanthropy award on Deborah's behalf. He received a standing ovation. The next day, I met with the mission board and told them why our family didn't want to name the chapel after Deborah, but I also passed along Denver's counsel, and so, of course, it was decided the new worship space would be called the Deborah Hall Memorial Chapel. Meanwhile, the fundraising drive for New Beginnings, the new mission facility, was officially underway. Within 2 days of Deborah's memorial service, while we had been floating on the river in Big Bend, the Snyders and our friends, Tom and Patricia Chambers, had donated $350,000 to the mission in her honor. That board meeting seemed to mark an end to the grace that had sustained me through Deborah's burial and memorial service, through Big Bend and the banquet. It also proved to be the last civilized stop before life spit me out on an unmarked trail. I was 55, graying at the temples, with half my heart lying in the ground at Rocky Top. How to survive? How to move forward? I felt trapped in a whiteout snowstorm with no guide and fresh out of supplies. The intensity of my fear surprised me. For weeks, I wandered through the house like a ghost in a graveyard. I haunted Deborah's closet, opening the drawers and cabinets, touching her scarves, her stockings, burying my face in her clothes, trying to breathe in her scent. Sometimes I closed the closet door behind me and sat there in the dark, holding the last photograph ever taken of us together. I combed through files and photo albums and made a scrapbook of my favorite pictures of her and letters she'd written. For several days and nights I sat on her bed in a daze, slowly turning the pages, reliving moments. The spring I fell in love with her and delivered lemon drops in a tiny brown paper bag to her at the school where she taught. The summer we got engaged, swimming in the lake, kissing underwater for so long we'd pop up sputtering for air, giggling that we'd nearly drowned, our autumn honeymoon in Vail. So poor we had to share a room with another couple, sunny days with the children in the park, winters building cowboy snowmen and exploring Indian caves at Rocky Top. I abandoned my Bible and read hers, not for words of comfort from God, with whom I was barely on speaking terms, but for Deborah's words, thousands of them scribbled in the margins of 2,094 pages. She had chronicled our valleys and mountaintops, struggles and victories in marriage, raising the kids, journeying with friends. Her words, not our money, jewels, antiques, or paintings by 20th century masters, were our family treasure, the outpouring of Deborah's heart, written in her own hand. My own heart felt shriveled and black, and my body shriveled with it. Nearly 6 feet tall, I weighed only 135 pounds. Friends told me I looked worse than terrible. I was glad. Thought it was proper. Mary Ellen asked me if I had a death wish. In a way, I suppose I did. I was wishing for someone who was dead. My fear gave way to anger, and I had plenty to go around. But as I fired arrows of blame at the doctors, the pharmaceutical industry, cancer researchers, clearly the bullseye was God. It was He who had ripped a gaping and irreparable hole in my heart. Without a gun or mask, He robbed me of my wife and stole my children's mother and my grandchildren's grandmother. I had trusted Him, and He had failed me. How do you forgive that? Thanksgiving came, a day to be endured, not celebrated, and a house that on Deborah's favorite holiday had looked like the Pilgrim's Feast. Denver and my parents were our only guests. I got up early, put a scrawny turkey in the oven, and walked out to the back deck, nursing a cup of coffee. As the sunrise gradually lit the valley, I watched bucks chasing does near the river. Every year until this one, I'd hunted deer on Thanksgiving morning, but death seemed too personal now. I drove up to sit with Deborah. I sat down on the big rock under the leaning oak, sinking deeper into misery as its blood-red leaves drifted to the ground around me. The white roses on Deborah's grave had turned brown. Only an ugly mesh of chicken wire shielded her resting place from wild animals. My heart stung as I asked myself how I could have left her here like this, with no wall or gates to protect her. Denver had told me he wanted to help me turn this place into a family cemetery, so we planned to do it together. In mid-December, he and I convened at Rocky Top to begin our labor of love, transforming the stark, lonely hill where Deborah lay into a safe harbor of rest. The evening before we started the work, we piled logs in the big stone fireplace and stretched out in leather chairs to warm our feet. Firelight glowed against Denver's dark skin as we reminisced about Deborah. "Remember when she threw me that birthday party, Mr. Ron?" "Sure do. At the Red, Hot, and Blue." Denver was turning 63, and Deborah had planned a little surprise party. After church, we'd taken him to the Red, Hot, and Blue, a barbecue restaurant where Denver and I often dropped in to eat pulled pig sandwiches with collard greens and sweet potatoes on the side. Scott and Janina and their kids showed up to honor the birthday man. "Denver," Deborah said after we ordered, "tell us about your favorite birthday party." He looked down at the table and thought a few moments, then looked back at Deborah. "Well, I reckon this is my favorite birthday party, 'cause it's the onliest one I ever had." "What about as a child?" Deborah said, surprised. "No, ma'am. On the plantation, we never celebrated no birthdays. I really never knowed when mine was till I was grown and my sister told me." Then he brightened. "So this birthday party is, sure enough, my favorite." Deborah had brought a little cake of chocolate with white frosting. She lit the candles and we sang happy birthday, the kids' voices chirping high while Denver smiled shyly. He smiled now at the memory, stretching his feet toward the crackling fire. "That sure made me feel good, and the barbecue and the cake was mighty good, too." "But you had a heck of a time wrestling with that barbecue," I said, remembering how showers of saliva squirted through his few good teeth onto the red checkered tablecloth every time he took a bite. "I sure enough did," he said, chuckling at the memory. He'd had such a tough time eating his birthday lunch that the next day I'd called Glenn Petta, a dentist who who had met Denver at the retreat. At the time, he offered to make Denver a set of teeth free of charge. When I called Glenn, he was happy to keep his word. The next time I saw Denver, he grinned a great big, "I've got new teeth" grin, revealing a full set of pearly whites lined up neat and tight as the grill on a 54 Corvette. "Well, you look like a movie star, Denver," I'd said, grinning back.
"Which one?"
I named the first one that popped into my head. "John Wayne." That seemed to sit well with him, but the teeth didn't. He wore them only to church. Said they got in his way when he ate. He wasn't wearing them now as we sat before the fire, the burning green wood hissing and popping, soothing us down into a drowsy tranquility. Finally, we heaved ourselves up, and I took Denver upstairs to show him the room where he could sleep. I desperately wanted him to feel welcome there. He had slept at Rocky Top a few times before, but not without coaxing. For one thing, he still preferred sleeping outside, and now that Deborah was gone, I'd begun to suspect he felt like a hanger-on. I didn't feel that way about him at all. In fact, during her illness and since her death, I had come to consider him my brother.
Chapter 58. I was real happy to be going with Mr. Ron to his ranch to help fix up the place where Miss Debbie was laid. But to tell the truth, I never felt as comfortable around him as I had around her. Not really, even though we'd been knowing each other for a couple of years. I was pretty sure that the only reason Mr. Ron tried to be my friend was 'cause Miss Debbie told him to. And I figured now that Miss Debbie was gone, wouldn't be too long before he'd cut me loose. That evening, Mr. Ron showed me the room upstairs again, even though I know where it was at. It's real cozy, with a little iron bed and everything done up cowboy style. I slept there before, but always on the floor, 'cause I ain't ever been real comfortable sleeping inside in the first place. But Mr. Ron said he wasn't going to hear about that no more and made me promise I was going to sleep in the bed. "See you in the morning," he said, and walked out the door, shutting it behind him. I just stood there real quiet in the middle of the room and listened to him thump down the stairs. When I heard his bedroom door close, I opened mine so I wouldn't feel so pinned in. Then I wrapped a blanket around me and laid down on the bed with the blanket up over my head like a hood and just my nose sticking out, homeless style. Didn't matter what I did, though. I just couldn't get comfortable in somebody else's bed. And I knowed I wasn't going to be doing much sleeping. I've been laying there for a couple of hours, still as a dead man and wide awake, when I heard something. Footsteps in the room. For a minute, I froze up, real scared. But then a kind of peace came over me, and I closed my eyes underneath the blanket. Then I felt the cover slip off my head and some soft hands, light as a feather, tucking them in around my neck. But I kept my eyes closed. Then I heard the voice of a woman, a voice I recognized. "Denver, you are welcome in our home." I opened my eyes, and there was Miss Debbie, healed and beautiful. Then, just as quick, she was gone. As sure as I'm telling you this, it wasn't no dream, 'cause I wasn't sleeping. It was a visitation. I laid there for a long time, trying to figure out why Miss Debbie had come. "You are welcome in our home. Our home." I took that to mean it was her home and Mr. Ron's home, and that I was still welcome even though she was gone. Now she was married to him for a mighty long time, so I figured she knowed him pretty good. That's when I knowed Mr. Ron had meant it when he said he was my friend. Right after, I figured all that out. That bed didn't feel like a stranger's no more, and I fell into a deep sleep.
Chapter 59. We awoke the next morning to a rose-colored sunrise that turned the frost pink, then gold, as the sun climbed into a cloudless sky. Denver seemed rested and especially cheerful. We parked ourselves on the back deck for coffee and watched as several deer crossed the pale river far below. Even from 300 feet up, we could hear their slim hooves cracking through the ice that had formed along the riverbank in the night. Since we'd planned to spend the day gathering rocks for Deborah's burial site, we were glad for the chill weather. Picking up rocks on a Texas ranch isn't a job you want to do before the first frost unless you feel like squaring off against an irritated rattlesnake. Together, Denver and I gathered rocks for 3 days, passing over the ordinary to choose just the right ones. Then, stone by stone, we laid a wall around the square of ground where I would someday rest beside my wife. We used the best rocks to build pillars that would support a wrought iron entry arch, proclaiming the cemetery's name, Brazos del Dios, the Arms of God. By that time, we'd been working for 6 days, and I thought I'd noticed a change in Denver, something lighter about his spirit. I couldn't pin it down. While we were stacking the heavy pillar stones, he solved the mystery for me.
"Mr. Rahn, I got something to tell you."
"What is it?" I said, shoving a piece of rust-colored limestone into place.
"Well, you might not believe this, but I saw Miss Debbie the other night."
I'd bent over to heave up the next stone, but straightened and turned to look at him.
"What do you mean you saw her?"
Denver pulled off his ball cap, mopped his brow, and tucked the cloth away in his back pocket.
"You know the first night we was here and you took me upstairs to show me where to sleep?"
"Yes."
"Well, I never did go to sleep. And after I'd been laying there for a while, Miss Debbie came into the room. Except she didn't look sick no more. She looked beautiful, like she did before the cancer."
Not quite sure what to say, I tilted my head a little and regarded him carefully.
"Do you think you were dreaming?"
"No, sir." He shook his head adamantly. "Like I said, I didn't go to sleep. It wasn't no dream. It was a visitation."
In my experience with Denver, during Deborah's illness, everything he'd said had always turned out to be true. The prediction that something bad was about to happen, the angels, her trying to get to heaven, even her life expectancy. As a result, I had come to believe things I once would have called unbelievable. I looked over at Deborah's grave, then back at Denver.
"Did she say anything?"
"Yes, sir. She said, 'You are welcome in our home.' I got to tell you, Mr. Rahn, I felt a whole lot better when she said that, because I was pretty sure after she went home to be with the Lord, you was going to cut me loose."
"Cut you loose?" I was stunned that he would think that. I'd come to take it for granted that he and I would be friends forever, just like he'd said that day at Starbucks. Then I remembered. When I first said I wanted to be Denver's friend, it was because Deborah pushed me into it. Then for a while, I had secretly seen myself as some sort of Henry Higgins.